three of them looked at each other and shook their heads to say that it wasn't their doing. Apart from them, privileges to place a target lock in the weapons system were also held by the arms control and target screening officers, but their lock placement had to be authorized by the captain or vice captain. That left just one other person with direct privileges to lock a target and launch an attack.
"We are idiots. He's only someone who's changed history twice. He realized all of this first. Who knows when he realized it? Maybe when Starship Earth was founded, or even earlier, when he learned that the combined fleet had been destroyed. He is the last to show worry, like the parents of his era, always keeping their children in mind."
Dongfang Yanxu flew across the spherical hall as fast as she could, followed closely by the two vice captains. They went out the door and down that long corridor until they arrived at the door to Zhang Beihai's cabin. Suspended in front of him was an interface identical to the one they had just seen. They rushed forward, but the scene from Natural Selection's escape replayed itself. They crashed into the bulkhead. There was no door, just an oval-shaped area where the bulkhead was transparent.
"What are you doing?" Levine shouted.
"Children," Zhang Beihai said, the first time he had addressed them this way. Even though his back was turned, they could imagine that his eyes were as calm as water.
"Let me do this."
"You mean, if I don't go to hell, who will? Is that it?"
Dongfang Yanxu said in a loud voice.
"From the moment I became a soldier, I was prepared to go there if necessary," he said, continuing with the weapons' pre-launch operations. From outside, the three of them saw that while he wasn't skilled at these operations, every step he took was correct. Tears welled up in Dongfang Yanxu's eyes, and she cried,
"Let's go together! Let me in! I'll go to hell with you!"
He made no answer, but continued his manipulations. He set the guided missiles for manual self-destruct so that they could be detonated by the mothership while in flight. Only after finishing the last step did he say,
"Dongfang, think. Could we have made this choice before?"
"Absolutely not. But now we can make it, because space has turned us into new humans."
He set the missiles' warheads to explode at a distance of 50 kilometers from each target. This would avoid causing the targets any internal damage, but an even greater distance would still be within the fatal range for any life aboard the targets.
"The birth of a new civilization is the formation of a new morality."
He removed the first safety lock on the H-bomb warheads.
"When they look back in the future on everything we've done, it may seem entirely normal. So we won't go to hell, children."
The second safety lock was removed. Suddenly, the alert sounded throughout the ship like the crying of 10,000 ghosts in the darkness of space. Display interfaces popped up in midair like snowflakes, showing a huge quantity of information that Natural Selection's defense systems had received about the incoming missiles, but no one had time to read it. There was a space of just 4 seconds from the sounding of the alert to the detonation of the infrasonic H-bombs. Images transmitted back to Earth from Natural Selection showed that Zhang Beihai may have understood all of this in just 1 second. He had imagined that his heart had grown as hard as iron through the arduous procession of more than 2 centuries, but he had overlooked something hidden in the deepest part of his soul, and had hesitated before making the final decision. He tried to restrain the trembling of his heart, and it was that last moment's softness that killed him and everyone on board Natural Selection. After the month-long face-off in the darkness, he was just a few seconds slower than the other ship was. 3 small suns lit up the blackness of space, forming an equilateral triangle with Natural Selection at the center, at an average distance of 40 kilometers. The fusion fireball lasted for 20 seconds and sparkled with infrasonic frequencies that were invisible to the naked eye. The returned images showed that in the 3 seconds that remained, Zhang Beihai turned to Dongfang Yanxu, flashed her a smile, and spoke. "It doesn't matter. It's all the same." The exact words were only a guess, because he didn't have time to finish before a powerful electromagnetic pulse arrived from 3 directions, vibrating Natural Selection's enormous hull like a cicada's wings. The energy in these vibrations was converted to infrasonic waves, which, in the image, looked like a fog of blood that enveloped everything. The attack had come from Ultimate Law, which had fired 12 cloaked missiles armed with infrasonic H-bombs at the 4 other ships. The 3 missiles fired at Natural Selection, which was 200,000 kilometers away, had been launched before the others, so that the ones fired at its 3 neighboring ships would reach their detonation points at the same time. A vice captain had taken over after the suicide of Ultimate Law's captain, but it was unknown who ultimately made the decision to launch the attack. And it would never be known. Ultimate Law was not one of the lucky ones remaining in the Garden of Eden at the end. Of the 3 other pursuing ships, Blue Space had been the best prepared against unexpected incidents. Before it was attacked, it had turned its interior into a vacuum and put all personnel in spacesuits. Because infrasonic waves were impossible in a vacuum, no personnel were injured, and the body of the ship suffered only minimal damage from the electromagnetic pulse. Right after the nuclear fireballs exploded, Blue Space began its counterattack with lasers, the fastest response possible. It lit up Ultimate Law with 5 gamma-ray laser beams and burned 5 huge holes in its hull. Its insides quickly caught fire, and there were minor explosions, causing the ship to lose all combat capability. Harsher attacks from Blue Space followed, and under continuous nuclear missiles and a rain of railgun fire, Ultimate Law exploded violently, leaving no survivors. At almost the same time as Starship Earth's Battle of Darkness was going on, a similar tragedy was taking place far on the other side of the solar system. Bronze Age launched a sudden strike on Quantum, using the same infrasonic H-bombs to kill off all life inside its target, but preserving the target ship whole. Because the 2 ships had sent only minimal information back to Earth, no one knew exactly what had taken place between them. They had both gone into intense acceleration to escape from the probe attack, but they had not decelerated like Natural Selection's pursuers had, so their remaining fuel ought to have been more than enough to return to Earth. The boundlessness of space nurtured a dark new humanity in its dark embrace. In the expanding metal cloud formed from the explosion of Ultimate Law, Blue Space rendezvoused with Enterprise and Deep Space, neither of which showed signs of life, and collected all of their fusion fuel. After stripping them of their hardware, Blue Space flew the 200,000 kilometers to Natural Selection and did the same to that ship. Starship Earth was like a construction site in space now, the massive hulls of the 3 dead ships dotted with the sparks of laser welding. If Zhang Beihai had still been alive, the scene would certainly have reminded him of the aircraft carrier Tang 2 centuries before. Blue Space took pieces of the 3 derelict warships and set them up in a Stonehenge formation, forming a tomb in outer space. There, they held a funeral for all the victims of the Battle of Darkness. Wearing spacesuits, the 1,273 crew members of Blue Space assembled in a floating formation at the center of the tomb. These were the remaining citizens of Starship Earth. Around them, huge pieces of spaceships towered like a ring of mountains, the gashes cut into the wreckage like enormous mountain caves. The bodies of 4,247 victims remained within this debris, which cast its shadows over all of the living as if they were a mountain valley at midnight. The only light was the iciness of the Milky Way, where it shone through the gaps between the wreckage. Moods remained calm during the funeral. The new space humans had passed through their infancy. A small votive lamp was lit. It was a 50-watt bulb, with 100 spare bulbs next to it, that would be automatically substituted in the lamp. Powered by a small nuclear battery, the votary lamp could remain continuously lit for tens of thousands of years. Its dim light was like a candle in the mountain valley, casting a small halo onto a high cliff of the wreckage and shining on a piece of titanium bulkhead engraved with the names of the victims. There was no epitaph. 1 hour later, the space tomb was illuminated one final time by the light of Blue Space's acceleration. The tomb was traveling at 1% of the speed of light. In several hundred years, it would decelerate to 0.03% of light speed due to the drag from interstellar dust clouds. It would still reach NH558J2 in 60,000 years, but Blue Space would already have headed off toward its next star system more than 50,000 years before that. Blue Space traveled deep into space, carrying plenty of fusion fuel and an 8-fold redundant supply of critical parts. There was so much material, it was impossible to fit it all inside the craft, so several external storage compartments were attached to the hull, completely altering the ship's appearance and turning it into an enormous, ugly, irregular body. Indeed, it looked like a traveler on a long journey. The previous year, on the opposite side of the solar system, Bronze Age had accelerated away from the ruins of Quantum in the direction of Taurus. Blue Space and Quantum had come from a world of light, but they had become two ships of darkness. The universe had once been bright too. For a short time after the Big Bang, all matter existed in the form of light, and only after the universe turned to burnt ash did heavier elements precipitate out of the darkness and form planets and life. Darkness was the mother of life and of civilization. On Earth, an avalanche of curses and abuse rolled out into space toward Blue Space and Bronze Age, but the two ships made no reply. They cut off all contact with the solar system, for to those two worlds, the Earth was already dead. The two dark ships became one with the darkness, separated by the solar system and drifting further apart. Carrying with them the entirety of human thoughts and memories, and embracing all of the Earth's glory and dreams, they quietly disappeared into the eternal night.
"I knew it!"
That was the first thing Luoji said upon learning of the Battle of Darkness that had taken place at the edges of the solar system. Leaving behind a baffled Shi Qiang, he ran out of the room and raced through the neighborhood until he stood facing the northern China desert.
"I was right! I was right!"
he shouted at the sky. It was late at night, and perhaps because of the rain that had just fallen, atmospheric visibility was excellent. The stars were visible, although they weren't nearly as clear as in the 21st century, and they were far sparser than before, since only the brightest could be seen. Yet he still swelled with that feeling he had on that cold night on the frozen lake 2 centuries ago. Luoji, the ordinary person, had disappeared, and he became a wall facer once again.
"Da Shi, I have in my hands the key to human victory," he said to Shi Qiang, who had followed after him.
Shi Qiang laughed.
"Oh?"
Shi Qiang's slightly mocking laughter dashed Luoji's excitement.
"I knew you wouldn't believe me." "So what will you do now?"
Shi Qiang asked. Luoji sat down on the sand, and his mood crashed rapidly.
"What should I do? It looks like there's nothing I can do."
"You could at least find a way to report it upstairs."
"I don't know if that would work, but I'll give it a try, even if it's just to fulfill my responsibility."
How high up will you go?
The highest. The UN Secretary General, or the chair of the SFJC.
That won't be easy, I'm afraid. We're just ordinary people now. Still, you've got to try. You can, go to the city government first. Find the mayor.
Very well. I'll go to the city then. He stood up.
I'll go with you.
No, I'll go alone.
Even at this rank, I'm still an official. I'll have an easier time meeting with the mayor.
Luoji looked up at the sky and asked, When does the droplet reach Earth?
The news said it'll arrive in 10 or 20 hours.
Do you know what it's coming to do? Its mission wasn't to destroy the combined fleet, nor was it to attack the Earth. It's here to kill me. I don't want you to be with me when it does.
Xie Qiang laughed the same mocking laugh again.
There's still 10 hours, right? By that time, I'll just stay farther away from you.
Luoji shook his head with a wry smile. You're not taking me seriously at all. So why do you want to help me?
My boy, it's up to the top whether they believe you or not. I always play things safe. If you were selected from out of billions of people 2 centuries ago, there's got to be a reason, right? If I delay you here, then won't I be condemned by the ages? If the higher-ups don't take you seriously, I won't have lost anything. It's just a trip into the city. But there's one thing. You say that the thing that's flying toward Earth is coming to kill you. I don't believe that at all. I'm well acquainted with killing, and that's excessive, even for Trisolarans.
They reached the passage from the old city to the underground city in the early hours of morning, and saw that the elevators going down were still functioning normally. Lots of people were coming out carrying large quantities of luggage. Few were going down, however, and on their elevator there were only 2 other people.
Are you hibernators? They're all going up top. Why are you going down?
One of them, a young man, said. On his clothes, fireballs shone continuously against a black background. A closer look revealed that it was an image of the destruction of the combined fleet.
Then what are you going down for?
Xie Qiang asked.
I've found a place to live on the surface, so I'm going down to get a few things, he said.
Then he nodded at them.
You on the surface are going to get rich. We don't have any houses there, and the property rights to the surface houses are mostly in your hands. We'll have to buy them off you.
If the underground city collapses and all those people rush to the surface, there's probably not going to be any actual buying or selling,
Xie Qiang said. A middle-aged man huddling in a corner of the elevator was listening to them, and he suddenly covered his face with his hands and let out a whine.
No! Oh!
Then he squatted down and started crying. His clothing showed a classical biblical scene. A naked Adam and Eve, standing beneath a tree in the Garden of Eden, as a bewitching snake crawled between them. It may have been a symbol for the recent Battle of Darkness.
There are lots of people like him, the young man said, pointing disdainfully at the weeping man.
Unsound of mind.
His eyes lit up.
Actually, Doomsday is a wonderful time. The most wonderful time, even. This is the only time in history where there's a chance for people to abandon all of their cares and burdens and belong entirely to themselves. It's stupid to be like him. The most responsible way of life right now is to enjoy ourselves while we can.
When the elevator reached the bottom, Luoji and Xie Qiang exited the hall and immediately smelled the strong, strange odor of something burning. The underground city was brighter than before, but it was an irritating white light. Looking around, what Luoji saw through the gaps in the huge trees wasn't the blue sky, but a total blank. The projection of the sky on the vault of the underground city had vanished. The blankness reminded him of spherical spaceship cabins he had seen on the news. The lawns were littered with a mess of debris that had fallen from the huge trees. Not far off,
was the wreckage of several crashed flying cars, one of which was in flames and surrounded by a crowd of people who were picking up other combustibles from the lawn and throwing them into the flames. Someone even threw in his own clothing while it was still flashing images. A ruptured underground pipe sprayed a high column of water, drenching a group of people who played around in it like children. From time to time, they would scream excitedly in unison and scatter to avoid debris falling from the trees. Then they would regroup and continue their revels. Luoji looked up again and saw fires in several places on the trees. The sirens of flying firefighting vehicles screamed as they flew through the air, dangling plucked tree leaves that had caught fire. He noticed that the people they met on the streets fell into two types, much like the two people they had encountered in the elevator. One type was depressed, walking with dull eyes or simply sitting on the lawns enduring the torment of despair, a despair whose cause had now shifted from humanity's defeat to the present difficult living conditions. The other type was in a state of crazed excitement and grew intoxicated from indulgence. Traffic in the city was in chaos. It took Luoji and Shiqiang half an hour to hail a taxi, and when the driverless flying car that carried them passed through the huge trees, Luoji was reminded of his first horrific day in the city and felt the tension of riding a roller coaster. Fortunately, the car soon arrived at City Hall. Shiqiang had been here several times because of work and was fairly familiar with the place. After a considerable number of steps, they finally received permission to meet the mayor, but they had to wait until the afternoon. Luoji had expected complications, so the mayor's acceptance of the meeting caught him by surprise, since this was an extraordinary time and they were little people. At lunch, Shiqiang told Luoji that the mayor had taken office the day before. He used to be the official in charge of hibernator affairs in the city government, and was, in a way, Shiqiang's superior, so he knew him fairly well.
"He's one of our countrymen," Shiqiang said.
In this age, the meaning of the term countryman had shifted from geography to temporality, but it wasn't used between all hibernators. Only those who had entered hibernation at roughly the same time counted as countrymen. When they got together across the long years, temporally based countrymen shared an even closer affinity than geographically based countrymen used to. They waited until 4:30 to see the mayor. High-ranking officials in this age typically possessed a star quality, with only the most attractive getting elected, but the current mayor was plain. He was about Shiqiang's age, but far thinner, and he had one trait that made him identifiable as a hibernator at a glance. He wore glasses. They were definitely antiques from 2 centuries ago, because even contact lenses had long since disappeared. But people who used to wear glasses tended to feel that something was wrong with their appearance when they didn't wear them, so lots of hibernators wore them even after their vision was repaired. The mayor looked utterly exhausted and seemed to have difficulty rising from his chair. When Shiqiang apologized for the interruption and congratulated him on his promotion, he shook his head.
"These are vulnerable times. Us rugged savages come in handy again.
You're the highest-ranking hibernator on Earth, right?
Who knows? As the situation develops, we might have countrymen promoted to even higher positions."
"And the former mayor? Mental breakdown?"
"No, no. There are strong people in this age, too. He was very competent, but he was killed in a car crash in a riot area 2 days ago."
The mayor noticed Luoji behind Shiqiang and immediately extended a hand.
"Oh, Dr. Luo. Hello. Of course I recognize you. I worshipped you 2 centuries ago, because out of those 4 people, you seemed most like a wall facer. I really couldn't figure out what you wanted to do."
But their hearts sank at the next thing he said.
"You're the 4th messiah I've received in the past 2 days, and there are dozens more waiting outside who I don't have the energy to see."
"Mayor, he's not like them.
2 centuries ago.
Of course. 2 centuries ago, he was selected from billions of people. And it's for that reason that I decided to see you.
The mayor pointed at Shi Qiang.
There's something else I need you for, but we'll talk about that afterward. First, let's talk about what you've got. But I have a small request. Can you not talk about your plan to save the world? They're always so long. First, just tell me what you need me to do.
After Luoji and Shi Qiang explained what they wanted, the mayor immediately shook his head.
Even if I wanted to help, I couldn't. I've got piles of stuff of my own I need to report to the senior leadership, but that level's lower than you imagine. It's just provincial and national leaders. It's hard for everyone. You ought to know that the senior leadership is handling even bigger problems right now.
Luoji and Shi Qiang had been paying attention to the news, so naturally, they knew about the bigger problems that the mayor referred to. The annihilation of the combined fleet saw the swift resurrection of escapism after 2 centuries of silence. The European Commonwealth had even drafted a plan to select 100,000 candidates for departure through a nationwide drawing, and the plan had been passed by a popular vote. But after the results of the drawing, the majority of those who had not been picked were furious, leading to widespread rioting. The public turned unanimously to escapism as crime against humanity. After the Battle of Darkness erupted between the surviving warships in outer space, accusations of escapism gained new meaning. Recent events had proved that when the spiritual bonds with Earth were snapped, people in space suffered total spiritual alienation. So even if escape were successful, what survived would no longer be human civilization, but some other dark and evil thing. And like Trisolaris, that thing would be the antithesis of human civilization and an enemy of it. It had even been given a name, Nega Civilization. As the droplet came closer to Earth, the public's sensitivity to escapism reached a peak. The media warned it was highly likely that someone would attempt to escape before the droplet's attack. Crowds flocked to the vicinity of the spaceports and the base points of the space elevators with the intent of cutting off all channels into space. They did indeed possess that ability. In this age, the citizens of the world all had the freedom to own weapons, and most of them had small laser guns. Of course, a laser pistol posed no threat to the cabin of the space elevator or the launching spacecraft. But unlike a traditional gun, a large number of lasers could focus their light on a single point. If 10,000 laser pistols fired at one point at the same time, they were unstoppable. Crowds numbering in at least the tens of thousands, with up to 1 million people in places, gathered around the base points and launching sites, and at least 1/3 were carrying weapons. When they saw a cabin ascend or a spacecraft launch, they would fire their weapons simultaneously. The straight path of the laser beam made aiming incredibly precise, so most of the beams would focus on the target and destroy it. In this way, Earth's transport links with space were almost entirely severed. The chaos grew worse. Over the past couple of days, the target of the attacks had shifted to space cities in synchronous orbit. Rumors flew thick online that certain cities had been converted into escape ships, so they too became subject to attack by the people of Earth. Owing to the vast distance, laser beams dissipated and were weakened by the time they reached targets in space, and given the additional factor of the space city's rotation, no material injury was caused. But the activity became a kind of collective entertainment for humanity in those last days. That afternoon, the European Commonwealth's third space city, New Paris, had been subject to simultaneous irradiation by 10 million laser beams from the northern hemisphere, causing the temperature in the city to rise sharply and prompting the evacuation of its residents. From the space city, the Earth had been brighter than the sun. There was nothing more for Luoji and Shi Qiang to say.
I was really impressed with your work at the Hibernation Immigration Bureau.
the mayor said to Shi Qiang. And Guo Zhengming. You know him, right? He was just promoted to director of the Public Security Bureau, and he recommended you to me. I hope you'll come work at the city government. We need people like you right now.
Shi Qiang thought for a moment, and then nodded.
Once I've settled things in my neighborhood, how's the situation in the city right now?
The situation is deteriorating, but it's still under control. Right now, the focus is on maintaining the operation of the induction field power supply. Once that goes, the city will collapse completely.
These riots are different from those in our day.
Yeah, they are. First, their source is different. They're sparked by total despair for the future, and are incredibly hard to handle. At the same time, we have fewer means at our disposal than in those days.
As the mayor was speaking, he pulled up an image on the wall.
This is the central plaza from a height of 100 meters.
The central plaza was where Luoji and Shi Qiang had taken refuge from the flying car. From this vantage point, the Great Ravine Memorial and its surrounding patch of desert couldn't be seen. The entire plaza was white, with white dots crawling around like rice in a pot of porridge.
Are those people?
Luoji asked in wonder.
Naked people. It's a tremendous sex party, with more than 100,000 people, and it's still growing.
Acceptance of heterosexual and homosexual relations in this era was far beyond anything Luoji had imagined, and some things were no longer considered remarkable. Still, the sight before them came as a shock to both of them. Luoji was reminded of the dissolute scene in the Bible before humanity received the Ten Commandments. A classic doomsday scenario.
Why doesn't the government put a stop to it?
Shi Qiang asked sharply. How would we stop it? They're completely within the law. If we take action, the government would be the one committing a crime.
Shi Qiang let out a long sigh.
Yes, I know. In this age, police and the military can't do much.
The mayor said, We've been through the law, and we haven't found any provisions for coping with the present situation.
With the city like this, it would be better if the droplet smashed it apart.
Shi Qiang's words jerked Luoji awake. He asked hurriedly, How long until the droplet gets to Earth? The mayor replaced the image of spectacular promiscuity with a breaking news channel showing a simulation of the solar system. The eye-catching red line that marked the path of the droplet looked like the orbit of a comet, except that it terminated close to the Earth. In the lower right was a countdown clock, indicating that if the droplet didn't reduce speed, it would reach Earth in 4 hours and 54 minutes. The news crawl was now displaying an expert analysis of the droplet. Despite the terror gripping the world, the scientific community had recovered its senses after the initial shock of defeat, so the analysis was calm and sober. Though humanity knew absolutely nothing about the droplet's energy source and drive mechanism, the analyst felt that it had run into a power consumption problem, because its acceleration toward the sun after destroying the combined fleet had been particularly sluggish. It had passed close by Jupiter, but, ignoring the three warships at the base, used the planet's gravity to accelerate, a move that further demonstrated that the droplet's energy was limited to the point of exhaustion. Scientists believed that the notion that the droplet would crash into Earth was utter nonsense, but they had no idea what it had actually come to do.
Luoji said, I have to leave, or else the city will really be destroyed.
Why? The mayor asked.
Because he thinks the droplet wants to kill him,
Shi Qiang said. The mayor laughed, but his smile was stiff. Apparently, he hadn't laughed in a long time.
Dr. Luo, you're the most self-absorbed person I've ever met.
Luoji and Shi Qiang drove off immediately after traveling back to the surface from the underground city. The city's inhabitants were pouring out in large numbers, which meant that ground traffic was so heavy
that it took them half an hour to leave the old city and reach full speed on the highway to the west. On the car's television, they saw that the droplet was approaching Earth at a speed of 75 kilometers per second and showed no sign of slowing. At that rate, it would arrive in 3 hours. The weakening of the induction field power supply slowed the car, and Shuqiang had to tap a storage battery to maintain speed. They reached the large hibernator residential area, but drove past New Life Village No. 5 and continued westward. They stayed silent along the way, speaking little and focusing their attention on the breaking news on the television. The droplet passed lunar orbit without slowing. At this rate, it would reach Earth in just half an hour. No one knew how it would behave, so to avoid a panic, the news didn't predict a point of impact. Luoji made a determined effort to welcome the moment he had long wanted to postpone, and said, "Da Shi, stop here." Shuqiang stopped the car and they got out. The sun, now nearing the horizon, cast long shadows of the two men on the desert. Luoji felt the earth beneath his feet turn as soft as his heart. He almost lacked the strength to stand. He said, "I'll try my best to reach a sparsely populated area. There's a city ahead of us, so I'm going to turn this way. You find your own way back, and get as far as possible from the direction I'm going." "My boy, I'll wait for you here. When it's over, we'll go back together." Shuqiang took out a cigarette from his pocket and looked around for a lighter before remembering that the cigarette didn't need to be lit. Like the other things he had brought from that distant past, his personal habits had not changed at all. Luoji smiled a little sadly. He hoped Shuqiang actually believed that, because at least that would make their parting a little easier to take. "Wait, if you'd like. When the time comes, you had better move to the other side of the embankment. I don't know how powerful the strike will be." Shuqiang smiled and shook his head.
"You remind me of an intellectual I met 200 years ago. He had the same hangdog look you've got. I remember him sitting out early in the morning in front of the Wang Fujing Church, crying. But he got out okay. I checked after I woke up. He lived to be nearly 100.
What about the first guy to touch the droplet, Ding Yi? I believe you knew each other too."
"He had a death wish. Nothing you could do about that."
Shuqiang looked up at the sky clothed in sunset, as if reminding himself what the physicist looked like.
"Still, he was a truly broad-minded man, the kind that could accept any situation. I never met anyone like him in my whole life. Seriously, a great mind. My boy, you ought to learn from him."
"And again I say to you, we're just ordinary people, you and I." He looked at his watch, knowing that there was no more time for delay. He extended a firm hand to Shuqiang.
"Da Shi, thank you for everything you've done for me the past 2 centuries. Goodbye. Maybe we'll meet again in some other place."
Shuqiang did not take his hand, but gave him a wave.
"Cut the crap. Believe me, my boy, nothing's going to happen. Go, and when it's over, hurry back and get me. And don't blame me if I make fun of you tonight over drinks."
Luoji got into the car quickly, not wanting Shuqiang to see the tears in his eyes. Sitting there, he strove to etch the rearview mirror image of Shuqiang onto his mind, then set off on his final journey. Maybe they would meet again someplace. The last time it had taken 2 centuries, so what would the separation be this time? Like Wu Yue 2 centuries before, Luoji suddenly found himself hating that he was an atheist. The sun had now entirely set, and the desert on either side of the road shone white in the twilight, like snow.
it suddenly occurred to him that it was along this very stretch of road 2 centuries ago that he had driven in the Accord with his imaginary lover, when the northern China plain was covered with real snow. He felt her hair blowing in the wind, its strands teasing him with their strange tickles on his right cheek.
No, no, don't say where we are. Once we know where we are, then the world becomes as narrow as a map. When we don't know, the world feels unlimited.
Okay, then let's do our best to get lost.
Luoji had always had the feeling that Zhuangyan and Xiaxia had been brought into this world by his imagination. He felt a stab in his heart when the thought entered his mind, because at this moment, love and longing were the most excruciating things in the world. Tears blurred his vision as he strove to keep his mind blank. But Yan Yan's lovely eyes stubbornly surfaced through the blackness, accompanied by Xia Xia's intoxicating laughter. It was all he could do to focus his attention on the television news. The droplet had passed the Lagrange point, but it still sped toward Earth at constant speed. Luoji parked the car at what he thought was the most fitting spot, the border between the plain and the mountains, where there were no people or buildings as far as he could see. The car stood in a valley surrounded by a U-shaped ring of mountains, which would dissipate some of the shockwaves from the impact. He took the television from the car and carried it onto the open sand, where he sat down. The droplet crossed the 34,000-kilometer geosynchronous orbit altitude and passed close by the space city New Shanghai, whose inhabitants all clearly saw the bright point of light pass rapidly across their sky. The news declared that the impact would occur in 8 minutes. The news finally predicted the latitude and longitude of impact, to the northwest of China's capital. Luoji knew that already. Twilight had fallen heavily now, and the colors of the sky had shrunk to a small space in the west, like a pupil-less eyeball watching the world indifferently. Perhaps as a way to pass the remaining time, Luoji began to look back on his life. It had been divided into 2 entirely distinct parts. The part after he became a wall-facer spanned 2 centuries, but it felt densely compacted. He passed quickly back through it, as if it had been just yesterday. That part of his life didn't seem like his own, including the love that was engraved onto his bones. It all felt like a fleeting dream. He didn't dare think about his wife and child. Contrary to his expectations, his memories of life before becoming a wall-facer were a blank. All that he could fish out from the sea of memory were a few fragments, and the farther back he went, the fewer there were. Had he really been to high school? Had he really attended primary school? Had he really had a first love? Some of the fragments bore clear scratches, reminding him that those things had indeed taken place. The details were vivid, but the feelings had vanished without a trace. The past was like a handful of sand you thought you were squeezing tightly, but which had already run out through the cracks between your fingers. Memory was a river that had run dry long ago, leaving only scattered gravel in a lifeless riverbed. He had lived life always looking out for the next thing, and whenever he had gained, he had also lost, leaving him with little in the end. He looked around at the Twilight Mountains, recalling that one winter's night he spent here more than 200 years ago, in the mountains that had grown tired of standing for hundreds of millions of years, and had lain down like old villagers basking in the sun, as his imaginary lover had once said. The fields and cities of the northern China plain had long since turned to desert, but the mountains didn't seem to have changed. They were still plain and ordinary in shape, and withered grasses and vitex vines still grew stubbornly from the crevices in the gray rocks, no lusher and no sparser
than 2 centuries ago. 2 centuries was far too short for any visible change to come to these Rocky Mountains. What was the human world like in the eyes of the mountains? Perhaps just something they saw on a leisurely afternoon. First, a few small living beings appeared on the plain. After a while, they multiplied, and after another while, they erected structures like anthills that quickly filled the region. The structures shone from the inside, and some of them let off smoke. After another while, the lights and smoke disappeared, and the small things vanished as well, and then their structures toppled and were buried in the sand. That was all. Among the countless things the mountains had witnessed, these fleeting events were not necessarily the most interesting. Finally, Luoji located his earliest memory. He was surprised to discover that the life he could remember also began on the sand. It was in his own prehistoric age, in a place he couldn't remember, and with people he couldn't recall. But he clearly remembered the sandy shore of a river. There was a round moon in the sky, and the river rippled under the moonlight. He was digging in the sand. When he had dug out a pit, water seeped through the bottom, and in the water there was a small moon. He kept digging like that, digging lots of pits and bringing forth lots of small moons. That was his earliest memory. Before that, everything was blank. In the dark of night, only the light of the television illuminated the small patch of sand surrounding him. As Luoji worked to maintain a blank state in his mind, his scalp tightened, and he felt like an enormous hand had covered the entire sky overhead and was pressing down on him. But then the giant hand slowly withdrew. At a distance of 20,000 kilometers from the surface, the droplet changed direction and headed directly toward the sun. The TV reporter shouted, "Attention, Northern Hemisphere! Attention, Northern Hemisphere! The droplet has grown brighter, and you can see it with the naked eye!" Luoji looked up. He could actually see it. It wasn't too bright, but its high speed made it easily distinguishable as it crossed the sky like a meteor and vanished in the west. At last, the droplet reduced its velocity relative to the Earth to zero and rested at a point 1.5 million kilometers away, a Lagrange point. That meant that, in the days to come, it would remain motionless relative to both Earth and Sun, squarely between the two. Luoji had a hunch that something else might happen, so he sat on the sand and waited. The mountains, like old men beside and in back of him, waited quietly with him and gave him a sense of security. For the time being, there was no more important information in the news. A world uncertain whether or not it had escaped catastrophe waited nervously. 10 minutes passed, but nothing happened. The monitoring system showed the droplet suspended motionless, the propulsion halo gone from its tail, and its round head facing the sun. It reflected the bright sunlight so that its front third appeared to be on fire. To Luoji, some sort of mysterious induction seemed to be taking place between the droplet and the sun. The image on the television suddenly blurred, and the sound turned scratchy. Luoji sensed commotion in the surrounding environment. A startled flock of birds took flight in the mountains, and a dog barked in the distance. It might have been a false impression, but he felt his skin begin to itch. The television's sound and picture jittered for a moment, and then cleared up. Later, it was learned that the interface was still present, but global telecommunications systems had quickly filtered out the sudden noise with their anti-interference capabilities. However, the news reacted slowly to this development because of the vast amounts of monitoring data that needed to be pooled and analyzed. It was another 10 minutes or more before precise information became available. The droplet was sending a continuous,
powerful electromagnetic wave directly at the sun, with an intensity far exceeding the sun's amplification threshold, and a frequency that covered all the bands that the sun could amplify. Luoji began to giggle, and then laughed until he choked. Yes, he really was self-absorbed. He should have thought of all of this long ago. Luoji wasn't important. The sun was important. From now on, humanity could no longer use the sun as a powerful antenna to transmit messages to the universe. The droplet had sealed it off.
Ha! My boy, nothing's happened. We really should have wagered on it.
At some point, Xie Qiang had made his way over to Luoji. He had flagged down a car to get here. Luoji felt like something had been drained out of him. He lay limply down on the sand, which was still warm from the sun. It was comfortable beneath him.
Yes, Da Shi. We can go and live our lives now. Everything's finished.
My boy, this is the last time I help you do wall-facer stuff, Xie Qiang said on the road back. That occupation must cause mental problems, and you've just had another episode.
I hope that's the case, Luoji said. Outside, the stars that were visible yesterday had vanished, and the black desert and night sky joined into one at the horizon. A section of road illuminated by the headlights stretched out ahead of them. The world was like the state of Luoji's mind. Darkness everywhere, with one spot incredibly clear.
You know, it'll be easy for you to get back to normal. It's time for Zhuang Yan and Xia Xia to reawaken. Although with the recent chaos, I don't know if they've suspended reawakening. But even if they have, it won't be for very long. The situation will quickly stabilize, I think. After all, there's still time left for several generations. Didn't you say you can go and live your life?
I'll go inquire at the Hibernation Immigration Bureau tomorrow. Xie Qiang's words reminded Luoji of the bit of color that existed in his dull mind. Maybe a reunion with his wife and child was his only chance for redemption. But humanity was beyond hope. As they neared New Life Village No. 5, Xie Qiang suddenly slowed the car.
Something's not right, he said, looking ahead.
Following his gaze, Luoji saw a glow in the sky, cast by a light on the ground, but the high embankments on the roadway meant they couldn't see its source. The glow was in motion. It didn't seem like the lights of a residential area. When the car turned off the highway, a strange and spectacular sight met them. The desert between New Life Village No. 2 and the highway had been turned into a shining blanket dense with lights, like an ocean of fireflies. It took Luoji a moment to realize that it was a crowd of people. All of them were from the city, and the light came from their clothes. As the car slowly approached the crowd, everyone ahead of them raised their hands to block the glare of the headlights, so Xie Qiang turned them off, leaving them facing a bizarre, gaudy human wall.
Looks like they're waiting for someone,
Xie Qiang said, looking at Luoji, who tensed up at his expression. The car stopped, and Xie Qiang went on.
You stay here and don't move. I'll go have a look.
He jumped out of the car and walked over to the crowd. Against the glowing human wall, Xie Qiang's stocky body stood out as a black silhouette. Luoji watched him walk to the crowd, then exchange a few words with the people, before turning and walking back.
Turns out they're waiting for you.
Go, he said, leaning on the door. Seeing Luoji's face, he reassured him.
Relax. It'll be okay.
Luoji got out of the car and went over to the crowd. He had grown familiar with the wired clothing of modern people, but in the desolate desert, he still had the feeling that he was walking toward the other.
But when he drew closer and could make out their expressions, his heart began to beat faster. The first thing he had learned when he awakened from hibernation was that the crowds of every age have their own unique expression. The differences across time to this far-off age were remarkable. You could easily distinguish between moderns and hibernators who had only just reawakened. But the expressions Luoji saw now weren't modern, nor were they 21st century. He didn't know what era they belonged to. Fear nearly rooted him to the spot, but his trust in Xie Qiang propelled his steps mechanically forward. When he had gotten closer to the crowd, he finally stopped, because he saw the images they had on their clothes. Their clothing displayed pictures of Luoji, some still photographs, some videos. Luoji had rarely appeared before the media since becoming a wallfacer, so he hadn't left much of a visual record, but a fairly complete set of those videos and images was now on display on the people's clothing. On some people, he even saw photographs of his pre-wallfacer self. The clothing took its images from the internet, which meant that these images must be circulating worldwide. He also noticed that the images were in their original state and had not been subjected to the artistic deformation that the moderns liked to do, which meant that they had just appeared online. When they saw him stop, the crowd moved toward him. When they got as close as 2 or 3 meters, the people in front held back the rest of the crowd and then knelt down. Those behind them knelt down successively in a wave of glowing people that receded along the sand.
"Lord, save us!" he heard someone say.
The words buzzed in his ears.
"Oh God, save the world!
Great spokesman! Uphold justice in the universe!
Angel of justice, save humankind!"
2 people came up to Luoji, and he recognized the one whose clothing wasn't glowing as Heinz. The other man was a soldier with glowing badges and ribbons. Heinz said to him gravely,
"Dr. Lue, I've just been appointed your liaison to the UN Wallfacer Project Commission. It is my duty to inform you that the Wallfacer Project has been revived, and you have been named the sole Wallfacer."
The soldier said, "I am Special Commissioner Ben Jonathan of the SFJC. We met when you had just been reawakened. I am also instructed to inform you that the Asian fleet, the European fleet, and the North American fleet have agreed with the revalidation of the Wallfacer Act and have recognized your status as Wallfacer." Heinz pointed to the crowd kneeling on the sand and said,
"In the eyes of the public, you now have 2 identities. For theists, you are the angel of justice. To atheists, you are the spokesperson for a just, superior civilization in the Milky Way."
This was followed by silence, with all eyes focused on Luoji. He thought for a while, but came up with only 1 possibility. "The spell worked?" he ventured. Heinz and Jonathan nodded, and Heinz said,
"187J3X1 has been destroyed."
"When?"
51 years ago. It was observed 1 year ago, but no one was paying much attention to that star, so the observations were only discovered this afternoon. A few desperate people in the SFJC wanted to find inspiration in history, and they remembered the Wallfacer Project and your spell. So they looked at 187J3X1 and found that it wasn't there anymore. In its place was a nebula of debris. They scanned through all observational records of the star until its destruction 1 year ago, then pulled all of the observational data of 187J3X1 at the time it exploded.
How do they know it was destroyed?
You're aware that 187J3X1 was in a stable period, like the sun, so it would be impossible for it to go nova. And its destruction was observed. A body traveling close to the speed of light struck 187J3X1. The tiny object, they're calling it a photoid, was observed the instant it passed into the periphery of the stellar atmosphere by the tracks it made. Even though it was small in volume, its near-light velocity meant that its vastly amplified relativistic mass had reached 1/8 of 187J3X1's by the time it struck the target. It destroyed the star immediately. The star's four planets were also vaporized in the blast. Luoji looked up at the night's dark sky, where the stars were practically invisible. He walked forward, and the people stood up and silently made a path for him, closing back together immediately behind him. They were all trying to push closer to him, as if yearning for sunlight amid the cold, but they respectfully left him a circle of space. A dark spot in a fluorescent ocean, like the eye of a storm. A man pushed forward and fell to the ground in front of Luoji, compelling him to stop, and then the man kissed his feet. A few others entered the ring to repeat that act. Just when the situation seemed about to go out of control, there were critical shouts from the crowd, prompting the people to scramble and retreat back into the group. Luoji continued on ahead, but realized that he didn't know where he was going. He stopped, found Hines and Jonathan in the crowd, and walked over to them.
"So what should I do now?"
he asked when he reached them.
"You're a wall facer, so of course you can do anything within the scope of the Wall Facer Act,"
Hines said to him with a bow.
"Although the Act still has restrictions, you can now mobilize practically all of the resources of Earth International."
"That includes the Fleet International's resources, too," Jonathan added. Luoji thought for a moment and said,
"I don't need to tap any resources right now. But if I've really recovered the power granted by the Wall Facer Act,
there's no doubt about that," Hines said. Jonathan nodded.
"Then I'll make two requests. First, order will be restored in all cities, and normal life will resume. There's no mystery about this request. I'm sure you understand."
Everyone nodded. Someone said,
"The world is listening, oh God!"
"Yes, the world is listening," Hines said. "Restoring stability will require time, but because of you, we have faith that it can be done."
His words were echoed in the crowd. "Second, everyone, go home. Leave this place in peace. Thank you." The people were silent after hearing this, but soon began to buzz as his words were passed back through the crowd. The crowd began to disperse, slowly and unwillingly at first, but eventually the pace picked up, and car after car headed off down the road in the direction of the city. The many people walking along the roadside looked like a long, glowing colony of ants in the night. Then the desert was empty once again. Only Luoji, Shi Qiang, Hines, and Jonathan were left on the sand littered with chaotic footprints.
"I am truly ashamed of my former self," Hines said. "Human civilization has a history of just 5,000 years, yet we cherish life and freedom so highly. There must be civilizations in the universe with a history of billions of years. What sort of morality do they possess?"
"Is there any point to that question?"
"I'm ashamed for myself, too. The past few days I've even begun to doubt God," Jonathan said.
When he saw Hines about to cut in, he raised his hand to stop him.
"No, friend. We might be talking about the same thing."
They embraced, tears streaming down their faces.
"So, gentlemen," Luoji said as he patted them on the back, "you can go back. If I need you, I'll get in touch. Thank you."
He watched them go off, supporting each other like a happy pair of lovers. Now he and Shi Qiang were the only ones left.
"Da Shi, anything you'd like to say now?" he said, turning to Shi Qiang with a smile.
Shi Qiang stood rooted to the spot, as stunned as if he had just witnessed a thrilling magic trick.
My boy, I'm damn confused.
What? You don't believe I'm an angel of justice?
You'd have to beat me to death before I'd say that.
And a spokesperson of a superior civilization?
A little better than an angel, but I don't believe that either, to tell the truth. I've never thought that was the case.
Don't you believe in fairness and justice in the universe?
I don't know.
But you're in law enforcement.
I said I don't know. I'm genuinely confused.
Then you're the most sober one here.
So can you tell me about the justice of the universe?
Very well. Come with me.
Then Luoji walked straight out into the desert, with Shiqiang following close behind him. They walked a long while in silence, then crossed the highway.
Where are we going?
Shiqiang asked. To the darkest place. They crossed the highway to where the embankment blocked out the lights of the residential area. Groping about in the dark that surrounded them, Luoji and Shiqiang sat down on the sandy ground.
Let's begin. Luoji's voice sounded in the dark.
Give me the easy version. At my level, I'm not going to understand anything complicated.
Everyone can understand, Da Shi. The truth is simple. It's the kind of thing that, once you hear it, you'll wonder why you didn't come up with it yourself. Do you know about mathematical axioms?
I took geometry in high school. Only one straight line can be drawn between two points. That kind of thing.
Right. So now we're going to set out two axioms for cosmic civilization. First, survival is the primary need of civilization. Second, civilization continuously grows and expands, but the total matter in the universe remains constant.
And then?
That's it.
What can you derive from those little things?
The same way you can figure out an entire case from a bullet or a drop of blood, cosmic sociology is able to describe a complete picture of galactic and cosmic civilization from those two axioms. That's what science is like, Da Shi. The cornerstone of every discipline is quite simple.
So let's see you derive something.
First, let's talk about the Battle of Darkness. Would you believe me if I said that Starship Earth was a microcosm of cosmic civilization?
No. Starship Earth lacked resources like parts and fuel, but the universe doesn't. It's too big.
You're wrong. The universe is big, but life is bigger. That's what the second axiom means. The amount of matter in the universe remains constant, but life grows exponentially. Exponentials are the devils of mathematics. If there's a microscopic bacterium in the ocean that divides once every half hour, its descendants will fill the entire ocean in the space of a few days, so long as there are sufficient nutrients. Don't let humanity and Trisolaris give you a false impression. These two civilizations are tiny, but they are only in their infancy. Once a civilization passes a certain technological threshold, the expansion of life through the universe is frightening. For instance, take humanity's present navigation speed. In a million years, Earth civilization could fill the galaxy. And a million years is a short time measured against the universe.
So you're saying that, taking the long view, the entire universe might have that kind of, what are they calling it? A dead hand?
No need for the long view. Right now, the entire universe has been dealt that dead hand. Like Heinz said, civilization may have started in the universe billions of years ago. Looking at the signs, the universe might be packed full already. Who knows how much empty space there is in the Milky Way or the universe, or how many resources are left?
But that's not right, is it? The universe looks empty. We haven't seen any other alien life apart from Trisolaris, right?
That's what we'll talk about next. Give me a cigarette.
Luoji groped about in the dark for a while, before taking the cigarette from Xu Qiang's hand. When Luoji next spoke, Xu Qiang realized he had moved to a spot 3 or 4 meters away.
We need to increase the distance to make it feel more like outer space, Luoji said.
Then he lit the cigarette by twisting its filter, and Xu Qiang lit one of his own. In the dark, 2 tiny red planets stood in distant opposition.
Okay. To illustrate the problem, we now need to establish the most elementary model of cosmic civilization. These 2 balls of flame represent 2 civilized planets. The universe is made up of only these 2 planets, and apart from them, there is nothing else. Erase all of our surroundings. Can you locate that feeling?
Yeah, that's an easy feeling to find in a dark place like this.
Let's call these 2 civilized worlds your civilization and my civilization. They're separated by a great distance, say, 100 light years. You can detect that I exist, but you don't know any details. However, I'm completely ignorant of your presence.
Right.
Now we need to define 2 concepts, benevolence and malice, between civilizations. These words themselves aren't very rigorous in a scientific context, so we've got to restrict their meaning. Benevolence means not taking the initiative to attack and eradicate other civilizations. Malice is the opposite.
That's a low bar for benevolence.
Next, consider your options for dealing with me. Please remember that the axioms of cosmic civilization should be kept in mind throughout the process, as well as the distance scale and the environment of space.
I could choose to communicate with you.
If you do that, you should be aware of the price you'll pay. You'll have exposed your existence to me.
Right. In the universe, that's no small thing.
There are different degrees of exposure. The strongest form of exposure is when I know your precise interstellar coordinates. Next is when I know your general direction. And the weakest is when I only know of your existence. But even the weakest form of exposure makes it possible for me to search for you, because since you've detected my existence, I know that I'll be able to find you. It's only a matter of time, from the standpoint of technological development.
But, my boy, I could still take the risk to talk to you. If you're malicious, then it's my bad luck. But if you're benevolent, then we could have further exchanges and ultimately be united into a benevolent civilization.
Okay, Da Shi. Now we've come to the crux of it. Let's return to the axioms of cosmic civilization. Even if I'm a benevolent civilization, can I determine at the start of our communication whether or not you are also benevolent?
Of course not. That would violate the first axiom.
So once I've received your message, what should I do?
Naturally, you ought to determine whether I'm benevolent or malicious. Malicious, and you eradicate me. Benevolent, and we can continue communicating.
The flame on Luoji's side rose up and moved back and forth. Evidently, he had gotten up and was pacing.
That's fine on Earth, but not out in the universe. So next, we'll introduce an important new concept, the chain of suspicion.
That's an odd term.
The term is all I had at first. It wasn't explained to me. But later, I was able to infer its meaning from the words themselves.
Who didn't explain it?
I'll tell you later. Let's continue. If you think I'm benevolent, that's not a reason to feel safe, because according to the first axiom, a benevolent civilization can't predict that any other civilization is benevolent. You don't know whether I think you're benevolent or malicious. Next, even if you know that I think you're benevolent, and I also know that you think I'm benevolent, I don't know what you think about what I think about what you're thinking about me. It's convoluted, isn't it?
This is just the third level. But the logic goes on indefinitely.
I get what you mean.
That's the chain of suspicion. It's something that you don't see on Earth. Humanity's shared species, cultural similarities, interconnected ecosystem, and close distances means that, in this environment, the chain of suspicion will only extend a level or two before it's resolved through communication. But in space, the chain of suspicion can be very long. Something like the Battle of Darkness